This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon. Rahul is off today, but I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Sheila Heestand. Welcome, Sheila.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Sheila, you are in Louisville, Kentucky, as I understand it.
Yes, sir. Yes, I am.
And before we began, we determined that although you're quite far west of where I am in Auburn, Maine, we're still in the same time zone, amazingly.
Yes.
Which is helpful in planning calls and interviews such as this one. And I think you're the very first lawyer we've had from Kentucky, which is great because we're really trying to get perspectives from all over the country. And I'm going to be really interested to hear about what it's like to practice trial law in Kentucky. But before we get into all that, I was reading your biography online, and I have to say I'm often have a feeling of insecurity when I read biographies from people that we interview on this show. And we've had really a lot of really amazing trial lawyers and human beings. But in reading your biography, I felt particularly insecure because starting with apparently appearing in two NCAA Final Four tournaments as a high-level college basketball player to being an accomplished musician, singer, trial lawyer, fluent in other languages, it seems like there's virtually nothing you can't do. So tell us a little bit about that. I mean, I'm always interested in people that have lots of skills and talent, but then still choose to become lawyers and try cases. Why did you do that?
I've always been a very competitive person. So, and I was always very involved. My parents both encouraged me to be involved in extracurricular activities. So I always did that. And I became a basketball player by default. I'm 6 foot tall and was 6 foot tall in seventh grade. So they're like, hey, you're playing basketball. So I played basketball from middle school on and was very lucky to be recruited by a great coach, Lee Wise, who was a Division I star and was an amazing coach at Center College and brought us from kind of a non-existent program to all 4 years I was at Center being invited to the NCAA tournament. And then by my junior and senior year, we made it to the Final Four each year. And I was the center for Center. And it's amazing. I've been practicing for over 30 years now. And just in September, we had a get together of all my girlfriends that I played ball with. And we went to Asheville, North Carolina, and had a long weekend. And it was like we had never fallen out of touch. And we don't. We keep in touch. We're getting together end of January, going to go see a women's game down at Center. Center's a Division III liberal arts college in Danville, Kentucky. And it really teaches you a lot of life skills. Playing basketball taught me a lot for trial work. I used to be really nervous when we'd be warming up and before the game, but I did the jump ball. And there was just something, as soon as the ref threw the ball in the air, you were in a different zone. You were in the game. You didn't hear the crowd. You heard your coach. You heard your teammates. You were completely focused. And that's kind of what trial work is like. You spend months and months and months getting ready for this moment. You walk into the courtroom. You're a nervous wreck. They say, Ms. Heestand, you may begin voir dire, which is what we call jury selection here in Kentucky. And you walk up and all of a sudden, you're completely unaware of anybody but you and the jury. And you're talking to the panel and getting into it. And it's just like basketball. And it's competitive because you got this defense attorney on the other side. And unlike a basketball game, these are much, much higher stakes because my clients are often either they've lost a family member or they're significantly incapacitated. So it was a blessing that I was involved in that and able to translate that into my practice.
Yeah, it's really interesting that we've had a lot of guests on the show who are great trial lawyers, and many of them have had backgrounds in sports, and sort of that's where they applied their competitive zeal when they were younger and before they became adults, I guess, so to speak. Do you find that the practice of trial law satisfies your need for competition?
I think it does. I will tell you that for many years, I also, in addition to being a trial attorney, I was participated in Ironman competitions, which is a triathlon competition that goes all day long. I need it for my mental health to be physically active. So I continue to do that. When I did Ironman, I called myself the turtle because I would finish dead last, but I'd finish by God. And so I am not by any stretch of the imagination a great athlete, but I am always competing and being physically active. I think that's important as trial lawyers for our mental health, that you be physically active. I just wrote an article recently about the importance of physical activity for your mental health and depression and anxiety and things that I think we all struggle with as trial lawyers. And one of the ways I handle it is to be physically active.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to kind of overstate the amount of anxiety and stress that can come along with this career choice. And you need some way to manage that. And I'm in your boat that physical activity and exercise is my go-to method of choice for the most part in trying to manage that. And it seems like that works for lots of people. And the other thing that I think a lot of people underestimate is the physical stamina required just to do the work and try the cases, you know, get up every morning and be physically fresh and focused and have energy. You have to bring energy to the courtroom.
I'll tell you, during a trial, I don't sleep. I might sleep a couple hours, but I'll wake up in the middle of the night and have what I think is a good idea and get up and start writing it down. And one thing leads to another. And then all of a sudden it's 5 o'clock and like, I got to be up already. So you're right. You have to be in shape to do this. And there's a lot of sleepless nights, even when you're not in trial. You wake up in the middle of the night and you start thinking about, okay, I've got this statute of limitations, or, you know, gosh, who do I need to depose in this case? And it just consumes your mind a lot of the time. So you have to have some kind of stamina to be able to take the sleeplessness, to be able to take the stress. You know, I was a defense attorney the first 8 years of my practice, an insurance defense attorney, and got an offer from an entirely plaintiff's firm to come over and increase their litigation department because they were doing mostly pre-lit. And I thought I was doing good work for folks in insurance defense. And I think a lot of the insurance defense folks are doing good work, but it's completely different to be saving an insurance company money versus helping an individual who's lost their home, lost their job, whose child will be on a ventilator the rest of their life. It's apples and oranges.
So you've been practicing now for about 30 years, is that right?
Yeah, yes.
And I'm interested, I mean, I could know a little bit about the landscape in the Northeast, but I'm not as knowledgeable about the Midwest or Kentucky. Did you find that there were barriers or challenges that you faced when you started your practice because you're a woman? I see on your website, you're dubbed the, quote, lady litigator, and you've been involved in helping and mentoring other women who are coming up through the ranks now. But I'm curious when you started, because I feel like although we've had a lot of progress in many fields, trial law does tend to be an area that, at least until maybe recently, was much more kind of male testosterone dominated. So tell us about how you broke in and became so successful in that against that backdrop.
So 30 years ago, when I started practicing, I was lucky enough to have an outstanding mentor, Leslie Bose, who's still practicing law. She's brilliant. And she would tell me stories of things that happened to her that boggled my mind. Being tall and athletic and outgoing, I didn't think I had any limitations just because I was a woman. And she said, just you wait. And she was absolutely right. Often I'd go to a deposition and people would assume I was the court reporter because I was a woman. They would try to mansplain, which wasn't a term back then, or talk down to me or intimidate me. And that's not something I take too kindly to. So I would give it right back. And luckily, with my personality, it has not been as much of a challenge as perhaps some other people. But what I've seen, I had an associate one time that she was young and she was brilliant. And I said, you need to be more aggressive. You need to be more vocal. And she said, that's not my style. And my style works for me. And she was absolutely right. She's more soft-spoken. But she gets just as much done as I do with her style because she's very, very bright and knows the law, knows the argument, and doesn't need to force feed it down someone's throat. So I think stylistically, we as women are learning that we can be delicate, we can be soft, we can be feminine, and still be excellent in the courtroom. That's not my style. I'm, again, more aggressive, but I'm glad to see it evolving, that there is room for women. There are so many women judges in Kentucky, excellent women judges. We have several Supreme Court justices in Kentucky that are women, many appellate court justices that are women, and they're sharp. They are sharp. We have one out of here in Jefferson County, Angela Bissig, who started out as a prosecutor in Jefferson County, went through the ranks, became an outstanding circuit court judge, which is our civil trial judge level for cases over $5,000. So any of the bigger cases, and then became an appellate court judge and a Supreme Court judge. And the nice thing about our women judges, at least I feel that I'm seeing, is that they're not just judges, lawyers, trial lawyers. They are actively involved in civics. They're actively involved in their community. They all have kids, so they're juggling that. And I know men have kids as well, but I think it falls differently on women in that I don't know if we feel a certain responsibility or it's a societal element, but I know for me as a mom practicing law that a lot fell to me to do the day-to-day things, which I very much valued and treasured. But you'll see all the female judges in our state, the vast majority of them have kids and have done it all and done it fantastically.
Right. I mean, it is amazing to watch. I feel like I benefited enormously from the fact that my wife, when I was early in my career, she was home. And so she was able to pretty much hold down the fort and I didn't have to worry about the kids and stuff while I was juggling my practice. Later, my wife became the Speaker of the House of our state and was the Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate. So she was running our state government, running a U.S. Senate campaign, and she was still doing everything at home. And I mean, I don't know how she managed to do that, but probably that's why women are often more effective at doing things in general, because they have to learn how to multitask. Whereas I feel like some of us have the luxury of kind of being laser focused on one thing, but not having to do that.
I think it really helps having kids and having to do all the things at once, because that's what trial's about. You are constantly distracted. Nothing goes exactly as planned. I mean, never. And if you walk into a trial thinking that you're going to call these four witnesses on Tuesday, you're absolutely wrong. That's not going to happen. I've had situations where my expert witness didn't get on an airplane for his testimony the next day, and we had to pivot and get the judge and defense counsel to agree to have him appear by telephone. This was before the era of Zoom. This was back in 2001. And you have to learn to be flexible. And being a person that practices law and runs a household, you got to do that. And, you know, there are a lot of men and women doing that nowadays. Single parents, God bless them. I don't know how a single parent practices law and raises a family and pays the bills, because it ain't an easy job.
No, for sure. So how did you go about making the transition from an insurance defense practice to doing plaintiff's work? And why did you do that?
So we had this great advertising attorney in Kentucky named Gary Becker. And he was one of a handful of attorneys that had the definitive case before the United States Supreme Court on attorney advertising. And he was advertising in Kentucky. And I'll be honest with you, when I was an insurance defense attorney, I thought attorney advertising was just the bottom of the barrel. And that was just the way we thought. And Gary called me. I was working late one day and he called me at the office and said, Sheila, I'd like you to come to our office. We want to make trial lawyers available to every man. And what we've been doing is basically pre-lit and resolving cases for them, but we want to make the cases worth more for people that don't know lawyers. And we want you to come and be a trial attorney. It took me months, my husband and I talking about it, because I thought, gosh, I don't know if I can do that, especially in the advertising realm. And luckily enough, I agreed to do it. And what you find is well over 70% of the population does not have access to a trial attorney. They don't know somebody who knows a lawyer, or they don't know a lawyer. And so they have to rely upon what they see either on the television or on the radio to get access to lawyers. And at least that was the case back at the turn of the millennium in 2000. And so I was able to get a lot more trial experience as a plaintiff's attorney in an advertising firm than I even was as an insurance defense attorney. And I had a big caseload. There were so many people that needed help. And I really feel like it's become a calling for me.
And once you took on that role, how did that change the way you started perfecting the craft of trying cases? Did you have to approach the cases differently? And how did you go about becoming successful at representing plaintiffs?
Well, I would certainly say I have not perfected the craft. I'm always learning and moving and adapting. Every day I'm reaching out to other attorneys saying, how can I do this better? But one thing I found is the best education for being a plaintiff's lawyer is having been an insurance defense lawyer. Because as an insurance defense lawyer, we recognize that the plaintiff's attorney has to push the case. If they want the case to be worth something, they have to say, I want to take your client's deposition. They have to send out interrogatories. They have to move for a trial. They have to move the case. When I moved into the plaintiff's realm, immediately I was like, if I want this case to be worth something, I'm the one that's going to have to do it. I can't rely upon the insurance defense attorney to prepare my client. I can't rely upon the insurance defense attorney to find experts for me. I've got to do everything. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of folks that go out and just hang out their shingle don't have that background of knowing that you have to take affirmative steps to move the case. That's more difficult than it sounds, because you have to take each case from the beginning and have a strategy and move that strategy forward. And it's easy, for instance, over the holidays to just say, okay, I'm going to take a break. But you can't take a break when you're a plaintiff's attorney. You have to constantly thinking, what's the next step?
It's so interesting that you describe that, because we were just having this conversation in our office the other day. You know, you're always trying to train and mentor new lawyers. And when you do that on the plaintiff's side, one of the challenges I find is that it's really hard to get that concept ingrained into the minds of lawyers, that although we talk a lot about high-level strategies and techniques, a lot of the success in cases is just bringing the energy to the case to move it forward step by step by step from point A to the end. And that does not happen without the force of your personality. And everybody kind of has a slightly different personal style and way they manage that. Can be aggressive, or it can be, you know, pleasant and cajoling perhaps. But ultimately, you have to move it. Inertia is not a good strategy for a plaintiff's lawyer.
No.
But it seems like that's probably just inherent to who you are as somebody who would be inclined to do that, which it's hard to teach that.
We're very lucky in Kentucky. We have some amazing trial attorneys that I've had the luck to watch, follow. One of the things that my mentor as an insurance defense attorney said, if you know there's a good attorney trying a case, take an afternoon and go listen to their closing or go watch them do a cross-exam. You and I were talking earlier about Pete Perlman here in Kentucky, who I think is one of the finest attorneys in the country. He's out of Lexington, where I lived when I was a defense attorney, and it was wonderful to watch him try cases. I have no idea how many cases he's tried, but it's a large number. He's so intuitive, and things seem to come naturally to him. But when you talk to him, he's like, it doesn't come naturally. I work at it. I put the hours in. I'm always looking for a better answer, a better solution. We have just amazing lawyers here, Ann Oldfather, Phil Grossman, Tyler Thompson, that are active on a national stage. That last year's AAJ president, Tad Thomas, he's a great trial attorney here in Louisville. So I've been blessed to be able to watch all these folks do their work. And it really is a team effort. On our listserv, we can put out, say, I'm looking for this kind of expert, or, hey, isn't there a case on this? I've forgotten what it is. And inevitably, somebody knows the answer. So I think it's really important that even though you're responsible for moving your own cases forward, you have to be able to rely upon other people in the bar to help you move those cases as well and help you do the best work for your client.
Yeah, that actually is a very impressive list of lawyers. I hadn't connected the dots that all of those folks are in Kentucky. And I understand that they give an award out for In the Name of Peter Perlman, and you actually won that award. So congratulations. What are the criteria for that?
It's a trial attorney award, but they also want to see someone that's been active in the community, that is interested in the civil justice system, that has a passion for pursuing Seventh Amendment rights. And those are all the things that Pete has done throughout his career. So I'm very, very, that's my highest honor to have been named that. And I can't say enough good things about Pete. He's a living legend.
Yeah, for sure. And just a great human being as well. We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, National Court Reporting Service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. So I wanted to talk to you about this judgment you received recently of $36 million in a case that involved a shooting at a high school, right, where two high school students were shot and killed and others were wounded.
Yes. Yeah. And it
came to my attention, and I was particularly interested because we're now involved in representing probably about 50 survivors and family members of folks killed in the shooting in Lewiston, Maine. So it's another case involving our epidemic of gun violence and shootings. But I'm really curious to hear about your case. And before we get to sort of the results and the strategy, do you want to just tell us the story?
Sure. So Marshall County High School on January 23rd, 2018, all the students before school pass through the common area. And a lot of kids hang out there, talk to their friends. And a young man, 15-year-old Gabe Parker, had been at home. His mother and stepfather kept a gun, a loaded gun, in their home, not locked up. He took that gun, walked into the common area before school started, and just opened fire. He killed one of my clients, Bailey Holt, 15 years old, wonderful girl, very active, incredible parents, Jason and Secret Holt, who had been very active since then in gun safety and trying to prevent this from happening. He killed another young man, Mr. Cope. He seriously injured several other people, including my other clients, Gage Smock, Mary Bella James, and Dalton Keeling. Just horrible injuries. Blew off the jaw of one young man, abdominal injuries to another, just life-altering injuries. And one of the things that was hardest about this case when we went before the judge asking for damages is talking to the three survivors that I represented, and then Jason and Secret's younger daughter, Bailey's sister. None of them, most of them are saying, I don't want to have kids, because I don't want it to happen to them, and there's no way to protect them. And they see every day on the news these mass shootings. They live through it. And right now, Ben, we don't have a way to protect them. Our position with Marshall County is they took no steps to prevent this from happening. And we, in response to the Sandy Hook shootings, our legislature passed a statute. It was House Bill 354, which was codified as KRS 158-162, and it overhauled the emergency management in schools. And one of the reasons that I thought we had a chance at overcoming the many immunities that county schools has, it said you shall prepare a written document to prevent, mitigate, prepare for, respond to, and recover from emergencies, and it listed mass shooters as one of those emergencies. They had done nothing to prevent. They'd done nothing to prepare for. They'd done nothing to mitigate. Now they will say, well, you know, we had drills. We had a drill in the fall and we had a drill in the spring. After this happened, they implemented no backpacks bigger than a certain size. They had all doors but one locked. They had metal detectors. They started out with wands and then they had the machines. They had all kinds of things in place to prepare for and prevent as the statute required, but they didn't have any of that in place beforehand. So we decided that we, with this statute in place, would sue the school board because it says that the school board shall do, the local board of education shall do this, and the school council and the principal of the public schools. So that's all the people that we sued, and including the superintendent as well. Under the argument, in Kentucky, they have folks that work for the county. They're considered employees effectively of the state, and they're entitled to sovereign immunity on some things, qualified immunity for acting in their individual capacity and not using discretion, so things that are ministerial. We argued that because the statute said you shall prevent, mitigate, that this was a ministerial action. The court disagreed with us. So all the folks that we had listed that were employees of the school system were eventually dismissed. That left us with the shooter, his mother, and his stepfather. So that's who we were able to get the judgment against. And so for me, it's very frustrating. I've done schoolwork from both the defense side and for years on the plaintiff side. I do not believe that our Court of Appeals, and up until this point, our Supreme Court, has adequately protected our students, anybody that's in the school, by using this qualified immunity argument. I think it's overreaching, it's too broad, and everything is being called discretionary, which is clearly not the case. When the statute says shall, that is not discretionary, that becomes ministerial. We have several cases on that point. Of course, I argued those. But the trial courts and the appellate courts are, I think, granting far too broad immunities. And I think if you look at the Sandy Hook litigation, they ran into the same problem. And we're not in old England. There shouldn't be sovereign immunity. This is not a kingdom. These are people that should be held accountable, people that are responsible for protecting our children. And when you talk to the children that have gone through this and they say, I don't want to have kids because I don't want to expose them to this, we need to do a better job of creating litigation, legislation, judicial decisions that do protect them and give these poor kids hope of having a future for their own children.
Why did this young man do this? What was the motive?
You know, he has never spoken. He has pled the fifth all along. He's in jail for the rest of his life. His parents have not spoken. We don't know what the motivation was. Interestingly, he was a member of the band. He did the shooting, left the common area, threw the gun down outside the common area, and went to the band room and hid in terror with the rest of the band students until other kids said, wait a minute, I got a text that it was Gabe Parker and he's up here in the band room. So those texts got to the authorities and the authorities came to the band room and arrested him.
And what kind of weapon did he use?
It was not a assault rifle. That much I know. I don't know the exact type of gun, but it was not an assault rifle. And I don't know if you've listened to Malcolm Gladwell's five-part series on gun control and gun issues in the United States. It's interesting. Any semi-automatic weapon, whether it's a handgun or an AR-type weapon, they can shoot bullets so rapidly that it's not just assault rifles that we need to be talking about. It's all weapons.
Do you think that there will be legislative changes that are going to come out of that, or have there been?
There have not been. There has been a lot of activity with the families going to the state legislature, but there has been no change to the statute I referenced to. There has been no affirmative change in Kentucky and changing the immunities. So this judgment was important to my families, to my clients, to have some bit of justice. It's the smallest amount, but it's some bit of justice because we're not getting it from the legislature or the judiciary.
Yeah, I mean, it's really great that you were willing to take on that case. I'm sure on the front end of it, it looked like a completely insurmountable challenge, particularly with various sovereign immunity and qualified immunity defenses that are present. And, you know, we're now, as trial lawyers, in every gun case, one has to do kind of cast a wide net for possible defendants and causes of action, because it may or may not have applied in your case, but some of the ones that would be obvious and most compelling have been prevented by our legal system, such as suing gun manufacturers for making dangerous products that are essentially marketed and peddled to adolescents who are not qualified or mentally stable enough to own and use them responsibly, and then they go and kill people with them. Any other kind of product, we would just sue the product manufacturer, right? But we can't do that.
Well, if you look at the Remington marketing scheme, the way they marketed it, it was not for killing deer, squirrel, turkey. It's for people killing. It's the most efficient people killer we have. And what the hell? You know, why is this being marketed in this fashion? And why can kids, even 18-year-old kids, I don't know if you remember being 18, but I didn't know my you-know-what from a hole in the ground. I have no business with an assault rifle. I'm not going to argue what gun control should be in the country, but when you look at the marketing schemes of these gun manufacturers, they're clearly wooing people to buy things to kill people, not just protect your home or to go hunting.
Well, it's heartening that you were able to take that case on and get a result. And I'm sure in Kentucky, there was a lot of attention on this issue, and I'm sure it was widely covered and very meaningful to the families that you represented. And it's a tough area of law, but it's great that people are out there willing to take that on and do that like you did. In the remaining time that we have for other trial lawyers who are listening to you and have heard or can read about your track record of success in representing individuals and trying cases to judges and juries, can you give people kind of some of your high-level pointers in terms of how you approach it and what you think makes you successful at what you do?
I try to surround myself with really great people. My paralegals are some of the best in the business. All the attorneys I've worked with, whether it was in a big firm or my current law partner, are much smarter than I am. I think you want to find people that are smarter than you are, because it's just going to make you better. Like I said before, I'm very involved in our Trial Lawyers Association and have learned so much from them. I'm very involved with the American Board of Trial Advocates, which is both plaintiff and defense in the judiciary. I think that keeps you on the cutting edge of the law. It keeps you educated, keeps you on your toes. You've got to read the most recent Supreme Court decisions and state Supreme Court decisions and appellate decisions, because the ball is always moving and you got to keep your eye on the ball. You can't become lackadaisical and just trust that, well, I know the law from 30 years ago, and surely that's still applicable. I mean, you're always having to change and adapt. I read a lot of books. There are a lot of great civil trial practice books out there, different methods, some of which I use, some I borrow some information, some I don't. But I think the more that you watch other people and learn from other people, the stronger you're going to be. I think once you become arrogant and overly confident, you're absolutely damned to lose your cases. I like having a sounding board. I have a lot of attorneys I'll call and say, hey, what do you think about this? And if you look, we had this really great thing in Kentucky, and I've noticed it. It's become more in the central United States. We call it the Kentucky Trial Verdict Reporter. And one of my law school classmates, Shannon Ragland, created it. And he reports on all the verdicts that we have in Kentucky, and now that's in Tennessee and Alabama and Louisiana. And it's fascinating to read because you will find you had no idea. You thought your case was special. Well, all of a sudden there's been a verdict on a case just like yours. So you can pick up the phone and call that trial lawyer and say, hey, what worked? What didn't work? What experts did you use? What wouldn't you do? And the group that a lot of the attorneys that I work with, and I don't know if you can do this in your state, we have to ask the judge if we can do it. But if you can, we talk to the jurors after a decision. And that's where you get the best information and best feedback is what did they like? What didn't they like? What persuaded them? And whether it's a win or a loss, you got to talk to them if you can. And reading that jury verdict reporter and finding out what people are doing and sitting in a room with them or picking up the phone and talking to them and learning from their wins and losses, I think is the best way to keep your trial practice moving forward. Another thing I've always felt is important is you've got to be in constant contact with your client. We tend to get bogged down in the minutiae of what we're doing from a deposition standpoint or what's the plan, what's the next step. But your client needs to know that you're there, you're working for them. I mean, when it comes down to it, we're no different than the guy at McDonald's who's getting you burgers. We are working for them. It's a service industry. So I think it's imperative that you stay in touch with your clients. I don't know. Those are just some of the things. I rely heavily on others and I rely heavily on my husband. He's a good man. He helps me take care of our family. He's a physician. I do a lot of medical malpractice. We have interesting dinner conversations. I'll say, hey, I got this really great call today. I think it's a great case. And I'll say, nah, that's crap. You know, there's nothing, that doctor didn't do anything wrong. And so I get different perspectives.
And you don't have to pay him for his opinion.
Exactly. Either. He likes to fly airplanes. So we have to pay for that. That's my donation, my contribution to his medical expertise.
What kind of doctor?
Interestingly, he went to school for 16 years after undergrad. He got his PhD in medicinal chemistry, went to med school, and then did med ped, so internal medicine and pediatrics, became board certified in that, and then did a fellowship in pulmonology, critical care, and sleep. So he's board certified in all of those. He did ICU medicine for about 8 years, and then he did primarily pulmonology, and now he's doing sleep. He actually worked for the health insurance industry for a while and is very glad to not be doing that any longer. That's something that needs to be fixed in our country, but that's a different podcast.
We might need a couple to cover that one. Well, Sheila, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story. If folks want to reach out to you and get in touch, how do they find you?
They can always call me at 502-233-8403. That's my direct line. They can go to my website at www.mhkylaw.com. I will return phone calls. I'll take phone calls. I'm happy to talk to anybody. If you have a similar case or you see me in a verdict reporter and want to talk about it, I'm always happy to talk to other folks.
Oh, that's terrific. I'm sure you'll hear from some folks. And thanks again.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.